From C-Cube Studios in Schenectady, New York, this is episode 3 of Little Brother for November 25th, 2000. In this episode of Little Brother, we'll talk about Carnivore, Free Radio Austin, Easy Pass, Runaway Monorails, SDMI, Verizon, and much more. So stay tuned, because Little Brother is about to tell on Big Brother. Thank you for tuning in to Little Brother, the show where we talk about telephones, computers, radio, hacking, freaking, social issues, and, like any little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host for the next half hour. Once again, I'd like to give a big thanks to Tim Lake for graciously donating a half hour of his airtime on radio station WRPI in Troy, New York, for this program. Without further ado, I give you episode 3 of Little Brother. Newly released documents concerning the FBI's Carnivore Internet Monitoring Program suggest that the system might capture far more information than the Bureau has claimed publicly. The documents were disclosed to the Electronic Privacy Information Center, or EPIC, as part of a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit filed by the Privacy Rights Organization. One of the documents, dated June 5, 2000, reports the results of tests performed on Carnivore version 1.3.4, which is currently in use. The report indicates that Carnivore, contrary to FBI assertions, is capable of capturing and archiving unfiltered internet traffic. It states, quote, "Carnivore was tested in a real-world deployment, having recently come back from a deployment. The machine had a single 300 MHz P2 processor running Windows NT 4 for a Service Pack 6 workstation. There were 384 megabytes of RAM, but the hard disk was relatively small at 1.19 gigabytes. This machine has both ZIP and JAS drives. This PC could reliably capture and archive all unfiltered traffic to the internal hard drive." End quote. The FBI's public defense of Carnivore has centered on the claim that the system only captures traffic that has been isolated by a software filter that minimizes collection and limits it to the particular information authorized for seizure in a particular court order. Thus, in testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee on September 9, 2000, FBI Assistant Director Donald M. Kerr stated, quote, "If the subject's identifying information is detected by the filter, the packets of the subject's communication associated with the identifying information that was detected, and those alone, are segregated for additional filtering or storage. However, it is critically important to understand that all other communications are instantaneously vaporized after that 1 second. They are totally destroyed. They are not collected, saved, or stored." The new disclosure comes on the eve of an important milestone in the debate over Carnivore. An independent review team from the Illinois Institute of Technology's Research Institute, or IITRI, was due to file a draft technical report on the Carnivore system with the Justice Department on November 17th. That report will not be made public until it has been reviewed and possibly edited for release by department officials. According to David Sobel, general counsel for EPIC, the new released information underscores the need for full public disclosure of Carnivore's capabilities. Quote, "The little information that has become public raises serious questions about the privacy implications of this technology," he said. "The American public cannot be expected to accept an internet snooping system that is veiled in secrecy." EPIC filed the FOIA lawsuit after the FBI revealed that it had developed an internet monitoring system that would be installed at the facilities of an internet service provider, or ISP, and would monitor all traffic moving through that ISP. EPIC's lawsuit seeks the public release of all FBI records concerning Carnivore, including the source code, other technical details, and legal analysis addressing the potential privacy implications of the technology. EPIC is a public interest research organization in Washington, D.C. More information about the case, including scanned images of the documents, is available at the EPIC Carnivore Litigation page, www.epic.org/privacy/carnivore. Last month, we reported to you about the closing down of Free Radio Austin by Federal Communications Commission and federal marshals. And guess what? 72 hours later, they were back on the air, and this month, on the 6th, it happened again. In a few minutes, we'll bring to you the last couple of minutes of audio broadcast on Free Radio Austin before they were shut down. But first, we have this interview with John from Free Radio Austin, conducted by, he's speaking to Skidmark Bob from Freak Radio.
Beloved FCC agent Lloyd Perry and U.S. Marshal about 6 APDs and I think one FBI agent came to our property today and handed me a warrant and proceeded to go back in the garage to get into our studio. We had a show going on, The Messenger was on at the time, and he was able to lock the studio from the inside, and probably had like 2 minutes of airtime after he knew the raid was going on to get listeners to show up and to put the word out. And they couldn't get to our door, so they came around the side and finally broke a window and crawled through that.
How many were there?
It's probably about 10 guys in all.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Were there U.S. Marshals as well?
One U.S. Marshal that identified himself. One guy that was at the other raid, who we have pictures of, but he's never identified himself.
Uh-huh.
Man, I think he's FBI guy.
Was the Austin Police Department there?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So what happened? Did they finally got into the studio?
They finally got in. They turned off the power.
Right.
And, of course, and once they were in, Messenger opened the door, and they proceeded to cut down our antenna and stole all our equipment.
Really? Were there some people protesting that there as well? Did people show up?
Yeah, because he was able to get the call out. And
on the air?
Yeah, on the air. And I was in the house, I was able to call people as well. They were really paying too much attention to me. And so within, 10 or 15 minutes, we had a big people. And within, 30 minutes, there was probably like 100 people here, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Listeners and programmers.
Did anybody get arrested?
Yeah, one girl actually did get arrested.
What happened with that?
Well, the FCC agent, they loaded up his SUV with all our equipment. He tried driving down our street, and people kept jumping in front of the car, and there was just a steady stream. Practically the whole protest followed his car or got in front of his car to keep him from getting away.
Yeah.
And the cops, as soon as somebody would get in front of the car, the cops would throw him out of the way of the car. And that went on all the way down the street as far as I could see and out of my sight. Heard it went down all the way down into the street, like a whole block down. And one girl, I was still in my yard because I had my kid with me. I have a 2-year-old, and
mm-hmm.
I was keeping an eye on him. But one girl did come back in handcuffs, and they took her away. And I believe there was a protest down at the police station. One girl got hit also by the car, and an ambulance came and got her.
Wow.
And the weird thing about that is after she got hit, the FCC agent Perry, Lloyd Perry, didn't stop.
He ran over her.
I don't know if he ran over her or hit her and she bounced off. It was out of my sight.
Right.
At the time. But I did see the ambulance take her away. And they had her, on a stretcher. got your eye.
Well, that's one way to defuse the situation, run over somebody, huh?
Right. And, as far as I know, you can't hit somebody with a vehicle and keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Last time I heard. So, I don't know what's gonna become of that yet.
Right.
Have to wait and see. I believe I heard she was gonna file suit, though.
So you guys were recently taken off the air, what, 2 weeks ago? How long has it been
now? We've been on a month, I think. I think we were closed down on, like, October 7th or something.
Mm-hmm.
We were up again October 10th, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And then they came in.
About a month, yeah.
So it took them a month to finally get around to shutting you guys down again.
Yeah, well, before they'd given us a warning, and it was more like a cease and desist type thing.
Right.
And I'm no lawyer, and I was trying to redo that, so, through the warrant, and, oh, thank you. And trying to make some sense out of it. And apparently this time, they were able to convince a judge that it would do them damage or injury or loss if they warned us about the raid. So they got a temporary injunction put into this where they didn't have to put any notice of it or give us any warning. So they were able to just come in really quickly this time.
Was there anybody's name on the injunction?
You know Reckless.
Yeah?
Yeah. She's
okay.
On it, and myself.
But she wasn't there, was she?
She was here eventually.
Oh, okay.
She was at work when it happened.
Okay.
And her and myself, and they've also added something new. Any and all Mary and John Doe's.
The inclusion of any and all John and Mary Doe's on the premises tends to raise concerns in my mind for the safety of anybody who may happen to be in the area, including those who may be protesting the shutting down of a free radio station by the FCC and federal marshals in the future. Now, as promised, we bring you the last couple of minutes of audio from Free Radio Austin.
Friends, I think it may be time to come and visit the station if you know where it's at. It looks like we may have visitors. Yes, we have police with a search warrant. So, come on and visit.
Can I see your search warrant? Why are you going to just let me see the pack here? Hey, John? Why can't I just see your search warrant? Well, my understanding is that you should show me the search warrant before I open the door.
I'm coming up right here.
Just slip it through, man. Right here on the... What are you doing? Just slip it through right here on the hinges.
Please, let me see your search warrant. Why can't I see a search warrant?
I find particularly disturbing in that particular passage the fact that through the entire raid you could hear for yourself the police appeared to be absolutely, totally, completely, and entirely unwilling to show the warrant before demanding and in fact taking by force entry into the radio station, despite the repeated pleadings of the messenger, "Show me the warrant and I will let you in." Some democracy we live in, huh, folks? The Associated Press reported on a problem with privacy and security on the New Jersey EasyPass website, where people can review their usage. AZ Pass is a radio transponder placed in your motor vehicle, which is red at toll booths, enabling you to zip through without having to stop and hand over cash. As, of course, anybody listening to me in upstate New York or downstate New York or, of course, the tri-state area is already well aware. Naturally, it keeps records of when and where you were for billing purposes, which is another risk altogether. But according to the story, a security breach forced New Jersey officials to temporarily shut down the service that allows EasyPass users to get monthly statements via email. The story contains claims and counterclaims, some of which are mutually exclusive, but then has this paragraph. They said Monday that it wasn't hard to break into the system. The person who discovered this discovered that the electronic statements aren't actually sent to drivers via email, but rather drivers are provided with a link to access their accounts. Presumably, the link for, say, example, October, might have read something like this. www.insertyouraccountnumberhere.200010.etc. And then all you'd have to do is replace your own account number with the person's you were looking for. Now, quoting one more paragraph from the story, it's something that an 8th grader who designs his own web page at home is perfectly capable of doing. It took 4 accidental keystrokes to display somebody else's account. I just checked the EasyPass website. They don't seem to have any comments posted. Dozens of travelers were stuck in an underground passenger train at Denver International Airport on October 19, 2000, after a computer problem sent the train shooting past the main terminal. It took workers about 20 minutes to move the train to a station where passengers got off. No one was injured. A circuit board on the automated train lost its memory and failed to read a barcode that signals it to stop. The train overshot the station and safety mechanisms kicked in. The RISC's archives are full of engineering designs without a fail-safe feature. One would think that the train would have a hardware interlock to stop it if something disturbed the computer. Failsafe also suggests that sensor events are required to enable and maintain motion rather than to stop it. The lack of sensor input or keep alive should result in a graceful shutdown. I guess that this train requires a computer to unlock the doors rather than a failsafe design that would require the computer to keep them locked. A team of computer scientists at Princeton and Rice Universities and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, or PARC, has been able to remove the invisible watermarks used by the 200-company Secure Digital Media Initiative, or SDMI, to protect digital music files from pirates. SDMI had offered a prize to protect digital music files from pirates. SDMI had also offered a prize to anybody who could defeat its various security measures. 4 out of 6, which make use of watermarks. SDMI's Tala Shannon said, "I expected some would have fallen. This is part of an empirical process to get the best technology." I want to take a quick moment to put down our local telephone company. Here in the eastern U.S., we're stuck with a telephone company called Verizon. And they are the result of a merger between Bell Atlantic, who was our previous monopoly, and GTE and AirTouch, who AirTouch have never actually been in the wireline telephone business, but GTE have, and they've been the local monopoly in some other locations. So they came up with this name, Verizon. Was selected from over 8,500 names, and according to their press release, it comes from the Latin word veritas, which means truth and also connotes certainty and reliability, and the word horizon, which signifies possibilities of ahead. Now, the thing of it is, the way I see it is this. Back in the mid-80s, a federal judge said to AT&T, "You're too big, you're too out of control. You really need to be split up and become a bunch of smaller companies who will compete with each other for services." Now, this was the advent of the baby bells. Now, the thing of it is that I'm seeing is that as time goes by, it's kind of like these various companies are pulling themselves back together into this big, amorphous, all-encompassing, and evil glob. Now, okay, maybe I'm being a little bit harsh with the word evil, but let's look at what's happened since Verizon has taken over as the telephone company for the eastern United States. Step one, not even a week into their existence. And I'm not talking about Verizon Wireless, I'm talking about Verizon as a wireline telephone company. Not even a week into their existence, they become... not even a week into their existence, their entire workforce goes on strike. There's got to be something fundamentally, structurally wrong with a company that can't even exist a week before the workforce goes on a two-week strike. Secondly, I have seen the quality of service drop tremendously. I've been attempting for the past 5 months to get a service called DSL installed. It's supposed to be something that's very easy to do. And yet, even after the strike was over, it took an additional 4.5 months, and it's still not here. Now, for those of you not in the know, DSL is Digital Subscriber Line. What this is a form of high-speed internet access. It's somewhere around about 20 times the speed of what you would normally get with a modem. And it is competing with the satellite and cable internet access methods that are out there. Now, the thing of it is, Verizon is one of the companies that's actually providing DSL service, and yet they have to provide the physical infrastructure for all of their competitors. Being who I am, I was very picky. I picked out one of their competitors instead of them themselves, and I've seen nothing but this nonstop chain of acts which all point to what could only be called criminal incompetence. Now, okay, DSL is a little bit of an exotic service. I will admit that. So, let's take something a little more ordinary. And I'll tell you a couple of horror stories that I have heard from some of my coworkers. Now, both of these people are people who have moved into the area in the past 4 months, you know, in the time since Verizon came into being. One of them moved from Minnesota, and what she encountered was that Verizon just simply could not deliver telephone service to her place. She doesn't live out in the boonies somewhere. She lives in the suburbs, in the place where Verizon is going to try, or should be trying, to run the most wires because it's where the most people live. And yet, it took 3 full months before Verizon could deliver an ordinary analog telephone line to this person. This is not rocket science. This is telephone service. This is telephone service that has been in use in some form or another for almost 100 years now. What's the big deal? Okay, let's forget that one for a moment. Let's move on to this other coworker of mine. You know, I'd be willing to call my DSL experience an isolated incident, and I'd be willing to call this co-worker's problem another isolated incident. And yet, I turn around and there's another one of my coworkers, also moved to the area very recently, since Verizon became Verizon, you know, since the switchover from Bell Atlantic, and he too has had problems. What has he had? Well, he moved into an apartment where he found that the telephone was already live. Aha! What's the big problem, you say? Well, what's the phone number? He didn't know. Nobody seemed to be able to tell him. When he attempted to have the service switched over to his name so that he could find out the telephone number, they couldn't do it because the previous person had never closed the service down. And we said, okay, fine. What's the telephone number? Well, they couldn't look up the telephone number either. So there he sat for 3 months, not even knowing his own phone number. Now, eventually, somebody showed him a way around that. And, of course, I can tell you that in this particular area, this doesn't work, of course, everywhere in the country. But in this particular area, if you pick up a phone and you dial 997 or 998, it will read your telephone number back to you. But this is not really, truly, deeply common knowledge. Only really the curious sorts such as yours truly pick up on things like this. But the thing of it is, this person could not receive any phone calls because he couldn't get telephone service because the previous person had not shut it off. What's a person supposed to do in this situation? I mean, if you go and you look this person up, let's suppose you found out who the previous tenant was, which of course you could do through your landlord, then you find out who the previous tenant was. How do you contact this person? You look their phone number up, you're going to get... Well, okay, you could get your own phone number back, but you just don't know, you know? What if the person turns out to be unlisted? Then you're screwed. At any rate, I'm going to end this diatribe now, but I'd like to ask for people who are listening to the show to let me know what they think and give me any ideas on what we can do about this company, because obviously something ain't right here. I can be emailed at critter@wizvax.net. Critter is CRITTER at wizvax, WIZVAX.net. The BBC reports that the world's first commercial power station powered by ocean waves has gone online. Built by WaveGen, who have issued a press release, the system uses the swell from waves reaching the shore to force air through a Wells turbine, which has the neat property that it turns the same direction regardless of which way the air flows through it. According to WaveGen, it's been estimated that if less than 0.1% of the renewable energy available within the oceans could be converted into electricity, it would satisfy the present world demand for energy more than five times over. Now, wouldn't that be nice? Neat trick. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening. This program has been produced at C-Cubed Studios in Schenectady, New York. This program is available for download at www.wizvax.net/critter. Higher quality downloads are available for broadcast upon request at critter@wizvax.net. Please feel free to distribute this program freely in any medium.